Live from Ellis Island Casino, it's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it. There could be a slip up in a game like this where you have, you know, high of a highs against the Ravens and you come out against a team that everybody's expecting you to beat. So we discussed that. We talked about the physicality. Talked about, you know, Andy Dalton and his efficiency, getting the ball out quick, understanding the offense. You know, just kind of looking back, I think all of us, myself, the staff, you know, it's just got to be better. It's got to be better. I want to get
better. It does have to be better for the Raiders. They got to start running the ball. This is ridiculous through three games. Their failings in the run game. Boy, they're sitting at 1-2, Willie. Willie Ramirez here, Cofield. Front yard, Ellis Island, come on down. We got two Monday Night Football games going on. Hometown hero, Dalton Kincaid with a touchdown catch. So, Bills up by two touchdowns. They are 1-2. It feels like they're 0-3, doesn't it? But they did beat the Ravens. So, but on these Mondays, when they play like this on a Sunday, the Raiders can be infuriating and sort of depressing. The Panthers? Come on.
Okay, let me ask you this. I want you to throw out anything that you've seen them do this season so far. Let's go back to August, July and August. Yeah. Would it be safe to say that in August, right before the first preseason game, you start looking at the schedule, would it be safe to say that you thought the Raiders, after this Sunday, would be 2-2 after playing in Inglewood, in Baltimore, at home against Carolina, and at home against Cleveland, they'll probably be 2-2. Would you have said that? Would you have thought they would be 3-1?
No, 3-1. I could see them being 1-3. I guess 2-2 was possible.
Okay, for me, I would have thought 2-2, losing in Inglewood, losing in Baltimore, winning, beating Carolina, and beating the Browns.
I wouldn't have said they'd beat the Browns.
I would.
But the Browns have been a lot worse than I thought they were going to be.
Okay. I figured that they would be more competitive against the Chargers, got beat up by the Ravens, beat the Panthers for their first win, and then carry that into week four and beat the Browns. Nevertheless, it doesn't matter how they've gotten to 1-2. If they win on Sunday, I think that there are a lot of people that would have had them 2-2 anyway. So if they can shake off the ugliness of Sunday's game, because they arguably were the ugliest team yesterday. Even teams that got smothered or humiliated or whatever. The Cowboys got beat down before they made a comeback, whatever. By the way, Ravens better check themselves in the fourth quarter. They lost to the Raiders at home. They almost lost in Dallas. If they pull off the win, they're right back to where everyone or a lot of people may have thought they would have been anyway, 2-2.
Avoiding 0-3 yesterday for other teams was massive. The numbers include 0-3 teams. Only six of them since 1979 have made the playoffs.
Right.
And just once in the last 23 seasons, none have won a Super Bowl. I would have never believed that if it wasn't sitting in front of me in print, because I'm usually glass overflowing guy when it comes to slow starts. Games are often won in the margins. I was like saying that. Coin flip moments. You can always rush back and have a good season. But, I mean, the proof is there. 0-3 in the NFL is a death sentence.
You like that margins. You know, Irregular Around the Margins was a great Sopranos episode, by the way. Anyway, Ravens, Rams, Broncos, Colts, Giants, and Panthers avoided that dreaded start, as my colleague Rob Matty wrote. Only the Titans are 0-3, not including these two teams playing tonight, the Jaguars and the Bengals, right? Bengals? They're both winless coming into tonight. So, when you look at those teams, which one of the six or which ones of the six can you say have a legitimate chance to, 0-2, and now they're 1-2, but where you could say they really did save their season because you really do believe that they could make a run at the postseason. I personally think there's only one, and that's the Baltimore Ravens. I don't think that the Los Angeles Rams, I mean, it was impressive how they came back and beat San Francisco. We had it in our picks, and it was never in doubt. We knew that was going to happen. The Broncos, I don't think, are going to do much. I think they're, you know, the Colts, I don't see it. The Giants, I definitely don't see it. The Panthers, I definitely don't see it. So, yes, I get what he's saying. He writes, six teams saved themselves, but one in particular to avoid that nasty trend that you read earlier was the Baltimore Ravens.
Time on a Monday to bring in our buddy from the Autumn Windbags, tried and true, media member first, fan second, the super passionate R.J. Clifford is up with Willie and Cofield. How are you, sir?
Big J journalist. That's what the J and R.J. stands for, guys. Don't forget it.
Yes. Okay. I loved, I think it was you retweeting someone about the Raiders and these types of games, like the Panthers game, like the Jets Saturday game, like the Baker Mayfield game, like the Tyson Bajan game, like the Falcons 43-6 game, like the Saints 24-0 game. Now there's the Andy Dalton game.
You know, it was, I think I said it last week. I don't know if I jinxed it or if I thought it so out loud that I didn't say it, but I thought I did. But wasn't it the most Raiders thing in the world in week two to go across the continent with the Ravens on a long week, well-rested, as the biggest underdogs in week two win, and then 7 days later in a home opener and a team that just changed quarterbacks against the worst team in football and then get blown out by the Panthers? I mean, if that's not lose, the Raiders,
not lose, but be looking
is?
At 36-7 in the freaking third, not just lose,
but get humiliated.
They scored one touchdown in non-garbage time. Like, I know it's like 36-22. It was a 36-7 blowout.
Right.
It was a shellacking, not even close. Just embarrassing. Like, this is like Antonio Pierce's most embarrassing game was the Minnesota game last year when they couldn't put up a single point when it was 3-0. This is his new most embarrassing game as Raiders head coach, getting shellacked by Andrew Gregory Dalton.
That's when you know a Raiders fan is pissed, when they know the opposing quarterback, the old man, they know his middle name, Gregory, huh?
I'm looking up like his home address. Like I'm borderline stalking right now. Like, this is the dude, really? Like, they're supposed to have this great defense, incredible pass rush, DBs that are getting their act together, and you go and just throw darts for 3.5 quarters? Like, the first quarterback to throw for 300 yards and 3 touchdowns this season? Really? This guy? He has gray in his beard, Cofield. There's gray in his beard, and he's still doing this.
It's incredible, but his red hair is beautiful. I'm going to throw a bet out right now, and I'll see if Willie or you will take it. I'm trying to think which way I want to go. Do I want to go straight Panthers over-under for wins? Or Raiders minus wins over the Panthers at the end of the season? How about Raiders minus 1.5 wins over the Panthers for the season?
I'm looking up the Panthers schedule right now. I know the NFC South is tonight.
You don't know. You shouldn't have to look up the schedule. Yeah. No, he can do it.
I do.
It's 1.5 wins.
I got to look it up.
Oh, my God. The Panthers, the Red Rifle, has inflicted that much fear in the Raider fan base that the Raider fans who thought they had a 3-touchdown win on the horizon against the Panthers, now you won't lay 1.5 wins for the season over the Panthers? Come on now.
Wow.
We just got shellacked. I mean, the Raiders just got beat up in all phases of the game. All phases of the game. We got run over. We couldn't run the ball. Our DBs couldn't cover. We couldn't get a pass rush. Like, look, I'm being overly doom and gloom here. This was the best example of what Max Crosby means to this team, because he's clearly hobbled. He's clearly not 100%. He's probably not even 50%. And the entire defense, this defense that we thought, it could be a top 10 defense, it all goes through Max Crosby. The games that prove Max Crosby should be defensive MVP, like basically every single season, aren't the games where he has 3 sacks, 9 tackles, 4 pressures, deflections. It's games like Sunday, where he did almost nothing because one of his wheels is broken and the entire defense collapsed. Like, everything stems out of Max Crosby. Max Crosby's playing well, That means they can't double work us, and they can't double work us, and we get pressure. When Max is in the backfield, the passes are errant. When Max is in the backfield and it's a run, the running back has to make his cut early, but he wants to. Like, everyone looks better when Max is healthy and doing Max stuff. When Max is hobbled, this great defense just gets destroyed by the Red Rifle. Like, it's like he's got to get healthy, or this great, great defense they're supposed to lean on all season is not going to do anything.
Okay. I agree to an extent that he is the leader. He is the motivational leader. He is the guy. But if they need him in the lineup, on the field, to do well, to get motivated, if that's the case, then we need to discuss Patrick Graham's future, because if you can't get the rest of the team fired up to beat what was supposed to be one of the worst teams in the league against a 36-year-old quarterback, there's a problem there. It doesn't just start with Max Crosby. It starts at the top. It starts with the coaches.
So Patrick Graham, if you remember last season, like once Antonio Pierce took over, it was the number one scoring defense in football. And I was nervous. Like, I thought Patrick Graham would be stolen away from us and get a head coaching job. Like, to turn the Raiders defense around the way that he did. The Raiders defense. The worst defense of the last two decades, consistently. Like those Paul Gunther years, those Gus Bradley years. I mean, it has been just absolutely atrocious. And he turned them into, for the, you know, that last nine games of the season, the number one scoring defense in football. Like, that is a minor miracle. Like, that's like Moses parting the Red Sea is less impressive. Like, that was incredible, right? So I'm not gonna get all over Patrick Graham quite yet, because his resume with the Raiders is so good. And honestly, like, he's the Yale mind. Like, Antonio Pierce is supposed to be the motivator. Like, you came in here with no head coaching experience. You're just a generic linebackers coach, but you can light a fire under the butts of this entire team. That's the only reason you're the head coach. Not your schematic genius. It's not your years of head coaching experience. It's not your in-game strategy. You're a motivator. That's the number one reason why you're the head coach. And if you can't motivate, then why are you here? What are you doing? What are you doing if you're not motivating?
RJ Clifford, Autumn Windbags. Find him on Twitter at RJ Clifford MMA. We'll get to some fight talk in just a couple of minutes. Okay. Don't misread what I'm saying, because I, again, you know from doing shows with me, I'm very glass overflowing. I always defended guys like John Jones. I kind of regret, well, I didn't. Okay, I thought Aiden O'Connell got the ball out quickly.
Okay. Are you insinuating that there's a quarterback controversy in Las Vegas?
I'm just saying there were some good signs. I know it was junk time, but I liked what I saw. I'm not saying switch now, but I liked what I saw.
So a couple of things. We knew all season long, right? It was a razor-thin decision, right? Whatever made the higher-ups decide on Gardner Minshew over Aiden O'Connell, we knew it was close. Like, it wasn't a landslide decision. So we knew if it didn't go well, then the next guy up, whether it was O'Connell starting and then Minshew would have to fill in, or Minshew starting, we knew that if the offense fell on its face, you can break glass in case of emergency. You had a backup quarterback that's basically as good as the starter, right? So this isn't a wild idea to throw Aiden O'Connell in there, right? I don't know how much I'm going to look at those last two drives. I mean, it was garbage time. The defense was in prevent defense. You know, they were letting them do the underthrows and stuff. But you do make a great point. The biggest hurdle with Gardner Minshew is that he's in the pocket for 2 seconds and immediately gets happy feet. Like, our O-line has been atrocious all season. The pass blocking was good on Sunday. It wasn't great, but it was good. Gardner Minshew had time. But he just, for whatever reason, after 2 seconds in the pocket, his hard drive just collapses, he gets happy feet, and he bails. Whereas Aiden O'Connell, like, if there's a blitz coming, he knows where his hot route is. He can stand in the pocket and go through his progressions, and he has his limitations for sure, but the biggest problem of Minshew is the strength of Aiden O'Connell. And we, you know, again, it was garbage time, but we kind of saw that in the fourth quarter, that he can get the ball quick. Like, he can process faster. He's got a quicker mind for going through his progressions. So, you know, his feet are stuck in mud. He's still just a second-year player, fourth-rounder. But, like, the one thing you were talking about, Cofield, like, he can get those reads. And that's all we need, right? Just get the ball to Brock Bowers and Devontae Adams. They will get open. Just Give them the ball. Just, here you go. Take over. Jesus, take the wheel. That's all we need you to do. And you can do it.
You know, it's funny to back you. It's not funny. To back you up, because I thought you might be sounding like a jabroni on the offensive line. Pro Football Focus, actually, of the guys who play the majority of the snaps outside of Cody Whitehair, the other four dudes kind of played pretty well, at least respectably, and even JPJ in his 21 snaps was pretty solid.
Yeah, Colton Miller looks healthy, looks 100%, right? Like he looked like not himself in the first two games. Dylan Parham was moving around, a little beat up, but still played pretty well. Like Andre James has been awful all season, but he had a decent game. Like again, the run blocking is it's historically awful. Like it is decades long bad by multiple metrics. It is really, really awful, and it's not just Zamir White. It's not just Madison. I think they need to start Madison. I think Alexander Madison needs to start. I mean, just he's more dangerous coming out of the backfield, catching the ball. Whenever Zeus is in the lineup, the defense is just kind of predicting run, and even then they don't respect it. Like they're playing light boxes, and still we're getting 1.2 yards per carry. But yeah, I mean, this line, like it was their best pass blocking performance yet. But Gardner Minshew, you're in an NFL caliber pocket. Like there's gonna be some commotion. You know, you're gonna hear some grunting. It's gonna be kind of scary. Stand in there and go through your progression. You just bail.
By the way, did your co-host come to Vegas for the game?
Yes, he was there. So the Autumn Windbag, the last home game, the last game I went to was the Thursday night Charger game, right? The 63-point blowout.
The pinnacle.
And then the next game the Autumn Windbag appeared at, it was this blowout. So when one of us is there, someone's getting new, good or bad. Just know it's not going to be a game. It's going to be a public execution whenever we show up to town.
Oh, boy. I want to switch to some fighting, but I got to do a giveaway before we get back to RJ Clifford. We got two tickets to go see A Perfect Circle, Primus, and Pussifer. Hello. All right, birthday celebration for Maynard James. Ticketmaster.com is where we get the tickets, and Griffin's going to hook you up. Caller 7-364-1100, 364-1100. All right, a couple of fighting topics because RJ is one of the kings of the SiriusXM MMA channel. Channel 159, right? 159?
156.
God dang it. 156. I know. Look at Willie's like, you're not prepared. You didn't do the research. Anthony Joshua.
Read the rundown.
I know. Read your own rundown. Anthony Joshua, I mean, listen. Yeah, well, you can tell us about the opponent. I mean, is this Raiders, Panthers? There's so many people counting on Anthony Joshua, you know, on this comeback to put up a big victory. He did not.
Daniel DuBois is just that good. I mean, he really is. Like, look, Anthony Joshua is 34 years old, lost 27. Joshua was like, you know, the money guy, right? The reason why there's almost 100,000 people at Wembley Stadium. And when we start thinking like money guy, you start analyzing with your wallet and not so much your brain. And you saw what Dubois did. He was looking great against, like, he only has two losses, Dubois. He was looking great against Usyk, the consensus best heavyweight in the world. So he got stopped in the ninth round. And he was just beating Joshua to the punch. Like, Joshua just, like, he just kind of, like, felt like he had to get him out of there. And he would just load up. And every time Joshua loaded up, Dubois would just counter and beat him to the punch. Like, in boxing at high, high levels, you have to hide your power punches. You can't just load up and go. And Dubois beat him. Knocked him down, what, four or five times in that fight? People were saying, oh, Joshua's chin, it's gone. No, it's not. He took five great shots from Dubois. He was knocked out, like, 21 of 22 wins. And he kept getting off the canvas until the very end. Like, I think Joshua was still in his physical prime. Just Dubois, just better boxer.
Yeah, 6'5", 248, as the heavyweight division just gets bigger and bigger. Dubois now with 22 wins, 21 by KO. So a clear victor and a clear loser. I thought we had that in Marab and O'Malley a couple weeks ago here at the Sphere, but I don't understand what Camp O'Malley is talking about, and I know you were debating last week, is Sean O'Malley kind of losing his likability factor? Is that because of camp members? What's going on?
So Sean O'Malley, Sean O'Malley's got a reputation in mixed martial arts where he basically thinks he's never lost. Chito Vera beat him cleanly, broke his leg with leg kicks, and he couldn't continue and won. Like, that is a mixed martial arts win. Sean O'Malley says, that doesn't count. he had a fight go to a no contest, because in a fight he was losing, he poked his opponent's eye so many times he couldn't continue. He's like, well, I was winning that fight, so that counts as a win anyway. And so I thought, okay, in a fight where you're just going to get out-wrestled, here comes the excuse train. Like, spin the wheel of excuses. What's Sean O'Malley going to say? Oh, it doesn't count because it was wrestling. Oh, if there were more rounds, I would have won. He sounds like the third Diaz brother, right? The first 4 days after his loss, he took the high road. Oh, he just wasn't my night. Sorry, I disappointed. I was injured, not an excuse. I'm going to have surgery, come back better than ever. I'm like, oh, he grew up a little bit. It took getting beat in a giant event like that to humble him and kind of understand where he is and grow a little bit. I'm like, oh, this is great. It's a great growing moment for him. I was bamboozled. He fooled us all. He goes into Twitter and says, no, I clearly won rounds 1, 3, and 5. I'm still champion within my belt in July. Like, okay, dude. Okay. Like, when you live on TikTok and social media and that's like your universe and you get that many yes men around you, you're going to have people be like, oh, yeah, for sure, totally. Wink, wink, nod, nod. You definitely won 3 of those 5 rounds. In the middle of like every metric, he got shellacked. So that's him. That's his generation. Gen Z's weird. I don't get him. That's just how it is.
I want to make sure this doesn't sound like back in my day, but listen, there are fighters coming all shapes and sizes. Hell, we had Randy Couture on last week, and Randy talking about acting now, it's like he goes to depths. So I was like, what is going on? He loves freaking acting. One of the most intriguing guys I ever interviewed, rest in peace, over the years, is Evan Tanner. Is there a documentary out on Evan Tanner? You can tell the audience here who Evan Tanner was for the people who weren't watching MMA a long time ago, but I always found him very fascinating and kind of always like, why am I here? What is life?
Yeah, Evan Tanner is one of those very, very deep introspective fighters. He's a former UFC middleweight champion, and he was in the mid-2000s was his heyday. And there is a fantastic documentary. It's been out for a while, but now it's just free on YouTube. It's called Once I Was a Champion. I highly recommend it. He's an incredibly intriguing figure with a very, you know, tragic, dark side. And you know, I won't spoil everything. Well, it's the beginning of the documentary, but he was an alcoholic, and he dies. I want like this might be like a suicide mission, but the way he connected with fans, the way he connected with people, he fought just like this bruiser and was built just like this bully. But he had this such deep introspection on how he looked at life. And you know, I thought you were joking, Cofield, when you texted me, you want to talk Evan Tanner. But yeah, like anyone, I had the pleasure of, you know, interviewing multiple times. I trained with him one time. He was actually training at my gym in Huntington Beach in like 08, whenever it was. And he just had this way of touching everybody that was around him in one way or another. And you see in that documentary all the different people he touched. And it's so weird because this, like, the analytical mind in me, the practical side of me is like, yeah, you're an alcoholic and you ruined all these people's lives. Like, they're crying because they're trying to help you and you couldn't. And you showed up into their life and you disappeared. But every single one of these people were like, I wish I could have done more. I miss him so much. He was such a good guy. And that was that crazy, weird dynamic about Evan Tanner. And it's put together brilliantly in the documentary, Once I Was a Champion, on YouTube. Check it out.
RJ, tell people in Vegas where they can check out your show. We know it's Channel 156. How often and when is it?
Monday, Tuesday, Thursdays, 9 to 12 o'clock Eastern Pacific on Channel 156 on SiriusXM. And I host the Autumn Windbags as well. It's on YouTube, all the different podcasts. Me and Juan Soto, who... whenever we show up, someone's getting news. So greater stuff on Autumn Windbags, MMA stuff on SiriusXM, and then, of course, social media at RJ Clifford MMA.
Thanks, RJ. We appreciate it, buddy.
You got it. Anytime.
I've talked to him. I'm not saying you've had this happen. You've interviewed a lot of cool people. I've talked to multiple athletes where I get done with the interview, and I'm like, I'm stupid. Like, they're just, like, they open up the imagination a little bit with conversation. So... that was Evan Tanner. I have to admit, the Raiders -1.5 bet against the Panthers for wins on the season is almost like a cry for help. Like, I just need action. That is absurd, and he didn't take it.
I don't know what's worse. Him not
I want to lose a bet and go to dinner with the guy. I was like, I'm giving it to you on the pun intended, the plate.
Yeah.
Easy bet.
Well, you actually threw it out for because you mentioned me, and I'm down to meals now.
I got dinners in hand.
Yeah,
I can start playing free and loose with dinners.
You're playing with house dinners.
I am playing with house dinners.
So I have to try to get some back by the end of the season.
We have not consummated enough bets this year, But as the season goes along, I think week 4 and 5 is a real time we can get some overreactions, some panics, some comebacks. You know I love the Dogs. The Cinderella story.
We might have to get a WNBA playoff bet.
Ooh, okay, yeah, let's address that. Put it on the tease board, the imaginary tease board for 5:45. Up next, though, as we hang out here, second game has started up. 7-0, Bengals, Jamar Chase touchdown. So Bengals lead the Commies, 10:40 left in the first. We saw Dalton Kincaid score. What's the update on the Bills and the Jags?
Jags kick a field goal 13-3. Bills are driving. I don't appreciate that Dalton Kincaid got in because I was winning by 60 points, 130 to 70.
Fantasy stats.
Yeah, and it's now 130 to 95. He has Dalton Kincaid, and he has...
Please don't go down the opposition's lineup on live sports talk radio about your fantasy. Please don't do it. Right, Griffin? Mute his mic. That's it. He's out. Literally. Tell me during the break.
All right.
I really want to hear it during the break. Front yard, Ellis Island. By the way, Mega Monday. I called him a schooner. That is a fishbowl of drinkage. You see those two drinks come out? That's buy one, get one. Buy one, get one on Mondays. Look at the side. They
downed it, too.
You know what that reminds me of?
The famous Shaq comedy show that he used to do, and Ari Spears was one of the most popular ones, where he impersonated Shaq and Charles Barkley, and Nelly was there, and there was just a random guy walking down, and he had a fishbowl, and he goes, "Look at this," and of course he said a word that I can't say because sure. Ari Spears, but he was, "Look at this." He got a fishbowl, and beautiful. the guy in the audience. That glass that these people have, he had some sort of like yak in it, you know, like Hennessy or Cavassier or whatever. But it was a way too big snifter glass.
Yes, I love it. Dodger talk on the way, Shohei talk on the way. One of the voices of the Dodgers, Tim Neverett, is in. And remember, for folks who don't know, Tim is a grizzled veteran of Mountain West Conference announcing. So we'll get his take on the latest chaos with conference movement.
15 seconds to air. Stand by, all cameras.
Ready with slow motion and isolated cameras. In less than 5, in 3, 2, 1.
Take tape.
Now back to Cofield and Company, live from the front yard inside Ellis Island on ESPN Las Vegas.
All right. I really want to start banging my head on the table. We've been tracking this conference chaos thing for hours now. Halfway through the show, Adam Hill confirms a report by Pete Thamel. All right, UNLV is committed to the Mountain West Conference. Then at the same time, we see the note that Utah State is going to take the Pac-12 offer. So here are the latest tweets on this. John Canzano, who covered the Pac-12 for a long time, he's based in Portland. He reported about 15 minutes ago, Utah State has signed an agreement with the Pac-12. Per source, it is member number 7. UNLV is still in play for the Pac-12, I'm told. Then a follow-up on that one from Pete Thamel, who says, sources, in the wake of Utah State's commitment to the Pac-12, UNLV's commitment to the Mountain West has not been formalized. The school sent in. It's maybe not the paperwork, but, hey, you know what? We're in. But that was predicated on all 8 schools committing in the Mountain West Conference. The school is continuing to explore options. Let's bring in Tim Neverett, who is a longtime broadcaster. He's covered a lot of Mountain West Conference action over the years, even going back to when it didn't exist over 25 years ago. Tim Neverett, my friend, this is pure insanity today.
Yeah, you know what? I wouldn't believe anything until it's actually done, because everybody likes to be the first to report stuff, and not everybody's always right. So, why didn't they just merge? You know what I mean?
Yep.
You got 2 teams hanging out there, and they're messing it up for everybody else. So, or 2 schools, I should say.
Yeah.
So the only thing that the Pac-12 has that the Mountain West doesn't is they've got the Power 5 designation. That's it.
Well, they've got a Power 5 name. They really don't have the designation because the AQ essentially is gone to the playoffs.
Right. And so, you know, but what you have, like UNLV has to be the most important property for anybody out west because look what you have in terms of the football stadium, where the football program status is right now, the basketball facility, the actual city itself, the things you can do here, conference meetings, media days, all the things that can be done in Las Vegas makes this market such a valuable asset. And when you have a team there, you know, it's a decent television market too. You know, where does the Corvallis, Oregon and the Pullman, Washington TV markets check in? I don't know. I just think they've been able to use the Pac-12 logo and make that a lot more valuable than what they had left over. I mean, they've got some money, that's for sure. And the Mountain West is going to get a windfall, a huge windfall of cash. But, you know, the easiest thing to do would have been just to, you know, do the right thing for everybody and add the two teams and figure out if you want to go Pac-12, if you want to call it the Mountain West. And, you know, this realignment stuff just, you know, it stinks on the surface. But, you know, if schools think they're going to make more money this way, who knows? And, you know, Pac-12 doesn't have a TV deal, do they? So there's just a lot more questions than answers, I think. I follow this stuff pretty closely. I'm still, it's kind of a guilty pleasure of mine still is following college football and the Mountain West especially, and then Pac-12, Pac-2 now. But I don't know. I just wish they did the smart thing and the right thing, and that's just take those two schools, make one conference, everybody's happy.
Yeah, I was sitting at the UNLV football press conference today, and a guy named Matt Neverett said that a guy named Tim was blowing him up about all the conference stuff. So I was like, you know what? I think Tim has a day off of the Dodgers, so we got to get him on. The other, and I know you're chastising the Pac-12 in this, and now the Mountain West is involved trying to pay people off. This, so much of conference realignment has been about a lack of loyalty, which cracks me up because the coaches all talk about loyalty. The presidents don't give a crap. And the other thing is, the key word is arrogance. And I think that's what it's all about. The collapse of the Pac-12 was about arrogance. The efforts initially to pull it together before Stanford and Cal bailed was about arrogance because they didn't want to be with the Mountain West Conference schools. And now the Pac, really the six-pack, is kind of being, again, arrogant, and they just got it shoved in their face with these AAC schools, four of them saying, no, thank you. It's like, check yourself and come up with something that really makes sense instead of pie-in-the-sky dreams.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a distraction too, really. And I think that with what they're doing, it's, gosh, you know, again, they don't invite me to those meetings, so I don't know what they're talking about every day. But just following it on the surface, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. I do think there's a big TV deal waiting to happen for a conference like this on, you know, the Western United States. That hasn't been there yet. I know that there was a TV deal for the Pac-12 that they turned down that probably would have saved the conference, but they didn't want a streaming service. And I think that the people who were the higher-ups who were maybe a little older didn't understand that college sports on a major streaming service would have done very, very well. And I still think it will. You know, whether it's Apple or Amazon, one of those two, I think that's kind of the next thing. But I was hoping you would see Oregon State and Washington State just find a way to coexist with the Mountain West and maybe become part of it, or maybe they did a reverse merger, whatever was going to happen. You know, there's dollars and cents that have to go in one direction or another that has to make sense. So, I don't know where we land on this, but there's going to be rumors by the hour. And, you know, I've seen this all the time in baseball around the trading deadline. Never believe anything till you see the press release.
Yeah. Tim Neverett, voice of the Dodgers, longtime voice of Mountain West Conference Sports. Okay, I mentioned the word arrogance. You can tell us better than we know. Shohei Ohtani seems to have zero arrogance about him, and it's one of the coolest things about his story. I mean, I knew he was going to be good this year. This is incredible, and you've been witness to most of it.
Yeah, it's like nothing I've ever seen in sports. Period, any sport. He's a Boy Scout first and foremost. He's extremely polite all the time. He's extremely respectful all the time of everybody, their time, their jobs, everything they have to do. You know, and I see him in private settings. I'm on the bus with him. I'm in the clubhouse with him. I see him around the hotel sometimes. You know, so he's just a regular guy when he's around us. You know, but he is this international phenomenon who puts up video game numbers at baseball, which is impossible to do. But what he's been doing lately, I've never seen anybody come close to doing. His numbers are, I don't know, they're otherworldly. And that's not hyperbole. I mean, I'm watching this guy actually do it. And coming up to the plate in the bottom of the ninth, I knew he was leading off. I knew they had a chance to tie the game with one swing. And it didn't take very long, and he hit the ball out. And then Mookie Betts came up three pitches later and won the game for him yesterday. But, you know, with what he did Thursday in Miami, going 6-for-6, getting to 50-50, you know, now he's got 55 stolen bases, 53 home runs. I think 55-55 is inevitable now. You know, whatever happens in the next six games is going to be remarkable, but everybody's going to remember you for what you do in October. And for him, this is his first October, so I know he's going to be pretty amped up. He never made the postseason with the Angels in 6 years. So Ohtani's going to be pretty amped up for the Dodgers. And, you know, as Ohtani goes and as Mookie Betts go and as Freddie Freeman goes, so go the Dodgers.
So Tim, Steve mentions, you know, longtime broadcaster here, you know, Mountain West, but I was thinking about you the other day because I was standing with our friend Steve Karp at City National Arena, three straight days, Golden Knights training camp, young Gage Quinney skating around the ice, and you spent time calling Las Vegas Thunder games with his father on the roster, correct?
I did, yeah. I actually met Gage last winter. We had a Thunder alumni night over at the Silver Knights game in Henderson. Got to see a lot of guys I hadn't seen in a while, but I met Gage after the game, which was really cool to have that opportunity to meet him. But yeah, you know, Ken Quinney, we just always called him Q. That was his name. I think they're calling Gage the same thing. But Ken was really good. He's a really, really good player. And my whole time with the Thunder, he was there. And so I got to know him pretty well. And I'm so happy for him. Not only that his son made the National Hockey League and is a professional player, but that he's doing it in Las Vegas, which, you know, if you told me that 25 years ago, I'd have told you were a liar. But it's happening. It's happening, and it's great to see. And he's doing a really good job. I know he goes back and forth between the Silver Knights and Golden Knights, but still, he's young, and hopefully he gets more ice time with the big club this year.
Yeah, and it's amazing that we started this conversation up talking about whether the UNLV Rebels were, or the UNLV athletic program was going to move into what could be perceived as a Power 5 if the Big 12's courting them. And back then when we had, you know, a handful of us, right? Colin Coward was in town. You were in town. Me, Paul Gutierrez was probably a UNLV student. But you think about how small it was back then, and we had the Thunder, we had UNLV, we had the random maybe events coming in, and now where we're at, and of course we've all talked and reminisced about it, but and now we're talking about UNLV going possibly being a Power 5 school.
Yeah, I think it's great, and I think it's something that is needed. And you know, Barry Odom was the right guy at the right time. That program's great. I watch as many games as I can. I listen to them now too. But I follow the Rebels quite a bit, and usually try to get to one home game a year when I can, when the schedule permits. And for them to be right now ranked 23rd in the coaches' poll is huge. I think if they beat Fresno State, then they'll be in the top 25 in the AP. They'll be ranked in both polls. Now, I was doing the games at UNLV when John Robinson was the head coach, and we were playing, you know, some pretty good teams. You know, we were playing Arkansas and Kansas and Wisconsin, and it was big boy football in the non-conference, and it was pretty good. And we had a guy named Jason Thomas, who was a left-handed transfer from USC, who was a Heisman Trophy candidate at quarterback for a while. So, I mean, you know, you started to get that level at that time, but still only won like six games, I think, was the maximum that we won in any year that John was there, 67. And, you know, to see what they're doing now, I mean, they're already halfway to bowl eligibility. That's a foregone conclusion. They're going to a bowl game, where that was never the case in the past. You didn't know. And now, yeah, they're going to go to a bowl game. Which bowl are they going to go to? Who will they play? Will they get that group of five spot and play in the national championship tournament now? And, you know, they've got as good a chance as anybody in the group of five to do that right now. And that's just really, really exciting to see what's happening with that program.
Tim Never with us. Let's close out on one more point about the Dodgers. We've got about 2 minutes left. Tim, of course, calls the Dodger games. What is this pitching staff going to look like? Or are we looking at basically, hey, let's just try to get through four or five and use the depth in the bullpen?
I think what it's going to be is probably Jack Flaherty, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, Landon Knack, who's a rookie, and Walker Buehler right now, and then the bullpen. And the starting pitching is going to be a challenge due to injuries. Clayton Kershaw is working hard to try to get back. I don't know if he's going to be on the playoff roster or not for the first round. They still have a starter that's been rehabbing, and he's just about ready to come back from Tommy John surgery. He hasn't pitched at all in the big leagues this year, and that's Tony Gonsolin. So he could be a factor as a long man or a piggyback-type starter, something like that. We don't know yet. They've got a big series starting tomorrow night with the Padres and then finish up on the road over the weekend with the Rockies, and then see where the chips fall and, you know, who they're going to play first in the postseason. But, starting pitching is going to be a big deal. They certainly have the offense. And anytime you have a guy like Shohei Ohtani playing the way he is, you got to like your chances of winning a ball game, especially when you have Mookie Betts, who typically heats up at this time of year. I was with him in Boston with the Red Sox when I did their games, and I saw him this time of the year always heat up, and he's starting to do the same thing. So, they've got some weapons, that's for sure. But it's baseball, and it's an expanded playoff now, so I look at it more like a tournament. If you get in and you have the hot hand, like Arizona did last year, you can go anywhere. So hopefully home field matters, and hopefully they get enough good pitching that they can get out of that division series, go to the championship series, and get to the World Series, and we have a parade.
Tim, we appreciate the time. Sorry we interrupted your day off, but enjoy the rest of the way, and we'll talk to you soon.
Well, no problem. Hope you guys have a good broadcast against Fresno State. I'll be listening.
Well, there you will. There he is, Tim Neverett. Giveaway time. His spot today is brought to you by Porta Subs. Calling right now, caller 7. You get a 2-foot classic sub from Porta Subs, your neighborhood sandwich shop, 364-1100, caller 7.
Cofield & Company presents Grab Bag on ESPN Las Vegas.
But Nylisa is like this 6'4" power forward who should be their enforcer. But you know why she can't be? She's dating and or likes Dejanay Carrington. This is how you know it's true. Nylisa Smith is a starter who played 9 minutes. 9 minutes. It's not because of foul trouble. It's not because of anything. It's because they know damn well that their most physical player has mixed emotions going into the game because Dejanay, her boo, is on the court.
Wait, what the hell's going on here? Nylisa Smith's not playing because...
It's Nylisa, first of all. It's not Nylisa. If he's going to be so critical about it with this big-ass mouth, he should know what their names are. It's Nylisa, not Nylisa. And, yes, it makes a difference. Steve Stive, right?
I didn't say it didn't.
I know. It's Nylisa, and yes.
So what's going on here with Dejanay and
she's
Nylisa?
She's dating Dejanay Carrington.
Are they not playing her because they're worried about her playing hard?
I don't think so. I don't think that's the case
at
all.
Why is she playing 9 minutes?
I don't know. I'm not Christy Sides. There's already, wow. I mean, all season the question mark is.
She's already asked out, right? Smith has already asked out, hasn't she?
Well, they're bringing in a new president. We got that press release because the old president's going over to do something with the Pacers, so they're bringing in somebody. There is going to be a new president. I don't know if Christy Sides is going to stick around. I don't know how much weight Caitlin Clark has with that decision. I do know this. Nylisa Smith's days in Indiana are done. I do agree with the fact that it's not good because I think it goes above and beyond Dejanay. I mean, no matter what, unless she goes to Connecticut's son, she's going to be on a team that's always going to be, you know. There have been talk about her coming here.
Would you trade for her knowing that when you play the son there might be some problems?
No, because I do think that there's times – like, there's been times where Nylisa's gone down hard and Dejanay goes up there to help her pick up or vice versa, and everybody thinks that's wrong. So – But Dejanay and Caitlin Clark have established this incredible physical rivalry, so it's probably not the best for her to be
on
the
team. So goes to pick up Smith, but is poking her in the eye on purpose, Caitlin Clark. Really?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and Clark elbowing Dejanay.
By the way, I went back and looked at the elbow. Absolute flop on Dejanay's part. She was the one who was head throwing.
All right, I'm done.
Yeah, get out of here. Pick up the mic. This is outrageous.
Oh, BS. You're crazy. No flop. Elbow, contact, lying out.
I watched it multiple times. There was no elbow. It was a hand extended.
Her elbow hit her in the eye. It was
a palm near her face.
Okay. Then there wasn't an intentional eye gouge from Dejanay.
Front yard.
Accidental swipe.
Ellis Island, come on down. Great setup here. $7 bites, $7 drinks. There's an all-you-can-drink special and all-you-can-eat special. Multiple big screens. Beautiful setting. We'll see you in a little bit. Cofield and Company here every Monday night. Ellis Island, Monday night football. Two games.